Chapter 22, More Guns. After the voyage of the Frieda, I got in touch with my German agent for the shipment of a second cargo of munitions. The purchase was not difficult. The problem lay in the loading and discharge. One minor bungle at the outset might ruin the labor of an entire voyage, but the greatest hazard was at home. Granted, our boys were willing enough, yet there were very few trained sailors and dockmen amongst them, certainly no one with executive nautical knowledge or experience. Another drawback, the most serious one, was the political situation in Dublin. Here, the opportunist, who was willing to bargain with the British and accept less than a whole loaf, delayed me for many weeks in my next voyage. The professor who had preceded me to Germany came home, leaving the purse strings of our munition exchequer in the hands of an American-Irishman living in Chicago, USA. He was a pensioner on Irish Republican money, living in ease and writing voluminous reports on the merest trifles. Our disrespect was mutual, and I had to use the strongest tactics to keep his fingers off the money I needed for munition payments. On one occasion, I had to stick my gun in his ribs. This man was a prominent figure in the casement fiasco, typical of the political theorist and American meddler who did so much harm to our cause. The casement record is a supreme example of meddling and bungling. Sir Roger was knighted for conspicuous service to Britain and humanity in general. He exposed the mayhem of the Belgians in the Congo and, further afield, the cruelties of Peruvians and Brazilians. Turning to Ireland for interest, Sir Roger was hanged for treason by the same arm that knighted him. His life and actions are a strange contradiction. He was almost a stranger in Ireland, being considered a loyal Briton. Backed by American money, Casement went to Germany to obtain the Kaiser's aid in Ireland. That move was based on a faulty political theory for a revolution. If the Kaiser had won the war and given Ireland help, our position would have been dubious and precarious. Casement, with characteristic audacity, attempted to raise an Irish brigade from among the Irish prisoners in German camps. Recruiting posters were distributed through the camp at Limburg, and Casement addressed the Sons of Erin, asking them to change their colours and their uniforms. His answer was sullen silence and an occasional mark of derision. A few of the captains listened to him, urged by a desire to escape the rigours of the prison camp, but they were not of the robust kind. I must point out that the Irishmen who did not follow Sir Roger were not necessarily loyal to Britain. They recognised Casement's wholesale folly. One of his volunteers turned informer to save his skin. There is only one exception to this general indictment of Casement's followers. I refer specifically to Robert Monteith, who came from Ireland to join the brigade. A remnant of this burlesque brigade I sent back to Ireland after the Free State came into being in the steamer City of Dortmund, which was later seized by the Free State forces. Casement, accompanied by his aides Monteith and Bailey, crossed to Ireland in a German submarine and was put ashore. The German ship Aude, formerly the Libau, was coming with a load of Russian rifles under the command of von Spindler. Yet no preparations were made for their reception and delivery. Without an Irishman aboard, the vessel cruised off the coast of Kerry looking for signals from the revolutionists that never came. Von Spindler anchored in Tralee Bay and there waited in vain for willing hands to help him dispose of the cargo. The rest is history. Von Spindler, pursued by a British destroyer, blew his vessel up on Good Friday morning. Casement and Bailey were caught. Monteith escaped to America. Sir Roger paid the penalty despite evidence that he had planned to head off the rebellion in Ireland. His diary tells of his curious pacifism, but more, it demonstrates the bewilderment of his brain and the confusion of some of his associates. Bailey saved his neck by turning informer. One Britisher said to me, "We hanged Casement with regret, for the strange man had strong impulses of sympathy that led him in unexplainable directions." Some day we shall learn exactly why Casement came to Ireland in the U-boat instead of in his munition ship, the Aude. Monteith, who is living in the United States, may be able to shed authentic light on this baffling phase of Ireland's abortive attempt at freedom during the World War. I make no criticism of Sir Roger's attitude towards the land that gave him his title. I merely offer his experience as a sample of a theorist bungler financed by American meddlers in Irish affairs. Von Spindler sailed the Oud through the North Sea to a point close to Iceland, south of the Arctic, and came down on the stormy Atlantic west coast side of Ireland. I chose to run the channel blockade. That von Spindler failed was no fault of his, but due to lack of coordination on land. Returning to my own narrative, I had no patience with the American lawyer who loved to dabble in international intrigue and gave him a wide berth except to collect such funds as I needed. My next ship, the Hannah, was a two-masted steel schooner with an auxiliary motor which gave us considerable trouble nearing home. My crew was a hardy German crowd, most of them with considerable U-boat experience. A week of buffeting about in the English Channel did not worry them. This time we sailed from Bremen, bound ostensibly for Vigo, Spain, with a cargo of cement. The merchandise was stored over the munition cases, and we argued that a curious inspector would hesitate at lifting a cement bag. It was on March 23, 1922, when the Hannah reached Bremerhaven, and we picked up the pilot for our seaward voyage. As he refused to risk going on board the pilot boat in the heavy sea, we dropped him later at the Weser lightship after spending a bad night at anchor. I'm resorting once more to a diary which I kept on this voyage, as the pages give a succinct record day by day of the progress we made from Bremen to the dock at Ring, a little village near Dungarvan in County Waterford. March 24th, about 4 a.m. Hove up anchor and proceeded to sea. Strong breeze from northeast was blowing, accompanied by snow and hail. Wind now dropped to a calm going around to the northwest, unluckily a headwind for us. However, we had the motor going and laid our course for Norderney Light. Passed this about 3:30 p.m. and headed for the Borkum Light, the wind freshening considerably. March 25th. Now blowing pretty strong. We are away to northward and eastward of our course, proceeding under sail alone, the motor being useless against wind and sea. Course altered on the other tack during night, and we headed south for coast, using motor. March 26th. About 4 a.m. in the morning, we sight a buoy, discover it to be the Terschelling off entrance to the Dutch port. By 9 a.m., we have passed it and head for Haak Light, entrance to Rotterdam. Wind has again dropped, and we are under motor alone, the sails flapping uselessly against the mast. Here I make unpleasant discovery. On leaving, I was told we had enough oil and water to motor alone for 10 days. Instead, I find we have about 4 days oil and 3 days water. We are thus dependent on the elements to complete our passage. March 27th, 5:30 a.m. A fine breeze has sprung up. The motor is stopped and we make a good 5 knots under sail alone. At 8 a.m. we set every available stitch of canvas and get over 7 knots. Noon, the wind has dropped somewhat and accordingly our speed. The captain considered we are off Dutch coast and should make Straits of Dover tomorrow p.m. I espy a lightship. The captain maintains she is the light off the Smorven Bank, relying on the chart for his information. At 6 we are close enough to distinguish it is Outer Gabbard light vessel off east coast of England. I am now positive that our navigation is faulty and take over this important work myself. Our course is altered to southward and we pick up flare of several lights along shore. March 28th. Last of lights was the Dunkirk light sighted this morning. I alter course until we pick up the Sandetti light. Trouble ahead. I sight small vessel flying examination flag and lying right across our course. I alter our course a point or so to clear ship at a good distance and await results. She kept drawing closer and ran up a 4-flag signal. The captain asked if we should answer, and I replied in distinct negative. No other move is made. In the meantime, wind is increasing. a heavy squall from direction of other vessel about northeast. It was now pretty difficult to make her out, presently enveloped in huge bank of rain, blotting her out of sight completely. Our speed now averaging 9 knots. An hour later, when squall passes, the light vessel is miles astern and our troublesome friend vanished. Our crew is unaware we are bound to any other port than Vigo and have no misgivings. The good winds lie right ahead, and I again alter course to prevent disaster heading for the Verne Light and Dungeness. Motor has been going from good winds to Verne Light, but I now order it stopped. We head for Royal Sovereign Light off Beachy Head, which we pass at 8 a.m. I now lay course for Start Point. March 29th. At 1 a.m., we pass Oa's Light, and at 3, as I had surmised, St. Catherine's, Isle of Wight. 5 a.m., we sight flash of the Needles. Wind now dropped somewhat. Before it blew strong from northeast, a favorable wind for us. By noon we are again drifting, waiting for another breeze. This comes, but is a headwind, and we ran away to southward. I am conserving oil supply for final run home from the longships off Land's End. About 8 p.m. we have more favorable wind and head toward coast, and about 9:30 sight flare of Portland Bill. During night, wind drops again, and we are again drifting southwards. March 30th, morning. Still unfavorable wind, very much unsettled. I have decided that by midday, should we still be heading off our course, I shall start motor. We again head right way. Weather beautiful, and we make about 6-7 knots. Wind increases, and I stop motor. Before dark, about 7:30, we catch flare of Start Point well abaft the beam, so I expect to make Eddystone before midnight at present rate of speed. April 1st, daybreak. Tropical calm, not a breath of wind. We see 3 sailing ships in same fix. Last night, after midnight, wind dropped altogether. I ordered motor to start, but owing to defect in packing, it would not function, and delay of 3 hours was necessary to allow engine to cool before repairs could be effected. In meantime, we drift idly. The attempt to fix engine failed, so we abandoned idea of progress by motor power, several following attempts also being failures. Every moment sky is more and more leaden and air oppressive. We are in for a spell of dirty weather. The glass went right down to 730, as low as it could possibly go. Breeze sprang up, which steadily developed in force. Favorable, and I headed the ship up for the Lizard, the wind being about west. At 4 o'clock we sight land, which I made out to be the Lizard, a couple of points in our lee bow. I go as close as possible, and then, with no chance of weathering point, put her round and head for open sea. Wind now increased to gale and sea running mountains high. We have this forward of the beam, which makes us roll frightfully. Other sailing vessels in our company follow our example in going about, but finding sea too high and wind increasing, dash for shelter of Falmouth, way to the north. This means of refuge is denied to us, so we have to weather it out. All night long we drive to southward. April 2nd. About 6 o'clock in the morning, wind having altered a little, we are able to head west. As the wind kept freeing north and west from our position, a difficult thing to locate by dead reckoning owing to the amount of drift, I laid course for Wolf Rock off Land's End. Speed 7-8 knots steadily. In the afternoon, I kept everyone on qui vive, looking for land. At 8 o'clock, we espy a red flash light right ahead, and 2 white lights abeam. These are confusing, so I have sail reduced and put ship about until I check our position. We are off the Scillies, between the islands and Wolf Rock. I immediately put ship back on her course and head northward again. Soon we pick up the Wolf well on starboard beam, so our position is now clear, although in a most dangerous locality as we have the Seven Stones rocks right ahead. I avoid these by altering course on sighting the Seven Stones light, and skirting northern end of the Scilly Islands. From point midway between Round Island Light and Seven Stones Light, I lay course for Irish land. April 3rd. All night we averaged 8 knots. A strong breeze blew from eastward in our favour. Make good progress in morning, but a big sea runs from Bristol Channel. So I keep ship, heading well up to windward. It would be fatal if we picked up land to leeward of our particular haven. 4 o'clock in afternoon. We see land away on port bow, and I am impatient to get closer. It looks unfamiliar. We see a lightship ahead about 6 o'clock, and discover it is the Barrels off the Wexford coast. We are a long way to eastward, which I attribute to bad steering. I alter course to westward, and pass through reefs and rocks known as the Salties. Ticklish work in a sailing vessel. We pass Conningbeg lightship and set course for Helvick. We pass Hook Light off entrance to Waterford, and everything here seems familiar and homey. Wind now increasing, and sea running very high, being from southeast, one of the worst winds on southern Irish coast. Soon we pick up lights of Minehead, with its 4 blinks. So we know long journey is nearing end. Away on starboard bow, we see a red light, which I take for Ballinacorty, but it increases in size to a huge glare. Very confusing. It is pitch dark and blowing a hurricane. An awful night to attempt to make a harbour like Dungarvan, with its terrible entrance blocked by groups of rocks, the gainers, that are veritable death traps. I head close to Helvig Head and signal with flare. No response. I reduce sail and proceed a little slower. The spanker peak halyards carry away in gale, and we have tough job getting spanker and gaff topsail in. Luckily, we get motor to work. The night is very dark, and vessel rolling heavily in big sea running. Out of the dark, I spy dark mass right ahead in our track, and I shout, "Backboard! Backboard!" just in time as we scrape past the gainer's buoy, clearing it by inches. Now we see signals on land, one alight blinking away from direction of Dungarvan, and 2 other flares under the head. To these latter, I cautiously grope my way, taking precaution to have both anchors clear for letting go. We are now getting close to lights, which I think mark entrance to Little Harbour in Helvick. I begin to feel anxious, for I know the risk in trying to make passage between the breakwaters in such a sea. Suddenly we hear a hail from close alongside, and a boat flashes past full of fishermen. They shout, "Let go anchor!" I stop motor, come astern, and sing out, "Let go!" As one anchor won't hold, I order the second to be dropped, and slack out 45 fathoms on each cable. This is done, and we wait for lifeboat, for such it is, trying to get out to us. They take precaution to have line fast from their boat to beach, so heavy is the sea, and after a long time succeed in getting alongside. They cannot understand how anyone would have nerve to make entrance on such a night, as not one fisherman could be induced to attempt it, nor even to venture out of Little Harbour to put pilot aboard us. A couple of fishermen and some members of IRA remained on board lifeboat, returning to shore with the crew pretty well fortified with a couple of flasks of best German cognac. April 4th. At daybreak, we rouse crew and attempt to start motor to enable us proceed into Helvick Harbour. We heave short on both anchors and wait for motor to start. It refuses to fire, and I determine to sail Hannah up to a little pier off Ring Village. I have both anchors raised, set foresail, and without undue trouble sail her there and warp the Hannah alongside the docks. A company of Republican soldiers come aboard, and the ship is unloaded in broad daylight, an audacious move which is indicative of the growing strength of the Republican movement. I went to the custom house, entered the ship, and got the necessary papers to clear the vessel for another port. The Waterford Divisional General and his staff were with me, all armed to the teeth. I said we were bound for Spain with cement, but had met a lot of bad weather with strong southwest gales which carried away a lot of our gear, so we ran for Helvig seeking shelter. This fairy tale would never have worked in normal times, but the presence of all the cannon gave the British customs official no option. I got clearance papers for Wexford, where I sold the cement. Later, I secured a cargo of grain and put the gunrunner Hannah into the channels of legal commerce, though not for very long. Ireland was now divided into three warring camps. In the northeast, the Orange men held 6 counties secure for Britain. The remaining 26 were divided into pro-treaty and anti-treaty groups. The anti-treaties, or Republicans, were for some queer reason called irregulars. The pro-treaty, or Free State forces, were openly pro-British and accepted British aid in men and munitions to subdue their former comrades in arms. In seeking for a solution of this unnatural complex, I came to the conclusion that the reason was neither complex nor strange. As in all small countries given a measure of freedom, officers outnumbered the rank and file, and everyone seemed to bear a military title. We suffered from a prolixity of leaders to fill the given number of jobs, whether Republic or Free State. There were 3 contestants for the President's chair: Collins, Griffith, and De Valera. For the post of Chief of Staff, there were many more than 3. All down the line, a similar situation existed. Results have proved that from 1922 until 1924, they fought like cat and dog for these positions. Now, finding punitive scrapping unpleasant, they battle in the ballot boxes. The Republicans soon forgot the principles of republicanism and are quite content to legislate in a Free State Parliament in a mutilated country. I chose to remain with the Republicans, or anti-treaty group. Liam Mellows, Cathal Brewer, and Rory O'Connor were the militant leaders of the Irregulars. The plans for getting arms into the country remained as heretofore, with the exception that others were now coming into what looked like an interesting and easy form of excitement. Our headquarters were in the forecourts, an imposing structure, and the central law offices for all Ireland. My partner from Germany, who was solely a business agent, received £10,000 from Liam Mellows to purchase arms. I was to buy a ship and get the arms out of Germany and into Ireland. My partner immediately assumed large ideas. With another Irishman who knew nothing of shipping and the risks involved in getting large supplies, he entered into an agreement to purchase £40,000 worth of arms and ammunition. They paid the major portion of the £10,000 as a deposit. I protested against the logic of such business, suggesting that it would be better to expend the money we had in hand on one load than involve ourselves in a deal without knowing whether the balance could be raised in Ireland. I pointed out that time was more important than a big shipment, which would take months to collect, with the thousandfold risk of detection by the Allied Commission. All my arguments were in vain. My friends had become Napoleons of high finance. The naval end of the campaign, however, they were quite willing to leave to me. As I had foreseen, there was the hitch in getting the balance of £30,000. My friends had decamped for Ireland, leaving me to cajole and placate the Germans. We waited weeks, but no word or sign came from Ireland. The forecourts had been shelled. The Republican forces were being driven to the hills. Soon our ports would be in the hands of the Free Staters. In desperation, I proceeded to London, put the case before the responsible officer commanding, and forced him to sail that night for Cork to raise the money. The IRA commandant in Cork raised the money in quick time. I was elated and left for Germany with the understanding that my friend would arrive there by another route as quickly as I would. The Germans were pleased to know that at last the money was forthcoming. A day passed, 2 days, a week, but no sign of the envoy. My position was the reverse of pleasant. There were threats and vague talk of imprisonment. At last, a delegation arrived from England. They had no money, and none would be forthcoming. The deal was off. I quit the Irish movement then and there. Incompetent meddling had destroyed my gun-running organization. Later, I was arrested in Berlin on a flimsy charge of passport violation, and the more serious charge of being connected with Bulgarian revolutionaries. My previous record was against me, and I anticipated a long term in a German fortress. However, I had sufficient private means to enable me to engage the best lawyer in Berlin. My release was negotiated, but on the condition that I left the state of Prussia forever. Thereafter, I retired to a monastery in the Black Forest, where I spent 2 months of rest and solitude. The year 1923 I spent in various pursuits in different parts of Europe, from Paris to the Balkans, using half a dozen passports to negotiate the various frontiers. November 1923 found me at a loose end in Belgium. In Antwerp, I secured a berth as second officer on a Belgian tramp steamer bound for the United States, and one cold evening, in the latter part of February, I walked ashore in New York determined to make good once again in the land of the almighty dollar.